What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Nuclear Barbarians. It is I, your Nuclear Barbarian, Emmett Penny. I'm back with John in the cut. We are here to do another reading series. What's up, John?
Yo, what's up? Man, if
Okay,
we keep
so
this up, we're gonna be like nuclear civilized.
yeah, I barbarians no more, dog. Okay, so that's actually like very on brand for what we're about to talk about today. So the reading series we're doing for the next, well, however long till we finish this book, and we're going to keep this up. We're like John and I have talked. We're very interested in delving into the history and philosophy of science and technology. We found that there's very little out there. There are a lot of people who don't go back and actually reread some of these foundational texts in the 17th and 18th century that actually do really inform how we think about our lives today. So, we're just going to keep rolling. And maybe these episodes aren't for everybody. That's okay too. We think this is important, and it's, spiritually, intellectually important to us to sort of get to the bottom of this. And so our first jump into that after Leo Marx's Machine in the Garden is The Theological Origins of Modernity by Michael Allen Gillespie. This is a book that I'd been meaning to read for a while, so I'm glad we're getting to it. And the reason we want to get into this is because there are all sorts of very valuable precursors to the scientific revolution and then the so-called industrial revolution that happens after that, that are very live for us today. And most of these debates begin in the medieval era. And you'll see, if we're here, how we are still in very similar intellectual deadlocks, ideological deadlocks that emerged in even the 1300s. Now, it might be surprising, but if I could phrase the premise of the book, it would have to be like the Morpheus meme, where it's like, what if I told you that your entire conception of the Enlightenment as a secular enterprise that did away with religion by force of reason is incorrect? What if I told you that what was actually happening was the creation of an entirely new religion that we live with every day? And that is part of what he's up to here. He says in the beginning that the task of this book is to show that modernity is not a secular project, but a religious one, that has all of these antecedents in the medieval realm. But we should back up just a little bit and talk about the occasion for him writing this book. And this was like a nice little trip down memory lane into near history, because the reason for it is 9/11.
Which blew my mind when I read that.
Yeah, I was like,
You wrote in
oh.
2008, so also at another like major point in American history. But yeah, that was fascinating because there's a certain point in which I guess he says that many people attempted to understand 9/11, or like it's essentially like the why do they hate us for our freedoms question is trying to get answered by this book. And he wants to describe, I guess, like a common set of concepts and terms in a discourse of which he thinks the Muslim world is also a part. And that if we understand how this discourse unfolded in European history, we could then understand the ways in which he thinks modern Islam embodies a position in that discourse still today, except we've forgotten the discourse, so we no longer know how to understand their position or like what they are saying. And he thinks that this will sort of help unpack like what it means, like what is 9/11, like what happened, what is our relationship to the Middle East, like questions that
And what's
were
our
on their
relationship to both God and nature, right? That's
Yeah,
sort of what he
exactly.
brings it to, where he's like, this is ultimately a question of the nature of man, the nature of God, and the nature of nature itself, and how those things are interrelated, and that we have been almost cosseted by our own success, and that we haven't even had to think about that as a debate. We've just been kind of, as Tocqueville pointed out in the 1830s, doing Descartes. That is just what we've been up to. And that has created a poverty of response. And also, I think he argues that it is also premised on misapprehensions of European intellectual history. And I think he's responding to a few different types of people. There's sort of the aversion, a knuckle dragging neocon thing, which he might, I would imagine he would describe that in more impolite terms of the why do they hate us for our freedoms, that type of thing. And then there is the, he quotes Thomas Friedman in here, or at least cites him. So there's sort of this globalist liberal position, like Fukuyamaism, the end of history. We're all just doing liberal democracy forever and capitalism with it. And then we have to figure out how to live with the trade-offs of that. And then there is what I would describe as the scientistic, atheistic response to 9/11, which I think is best embodied by men like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, among many others, who basically saw the Muslim world as the same way that Christian, that like the same way that Greeks, the Athenians, greeted people who couldn't speak their language, literally as barbarians. You know, that there are these anachronistic throwbacks that are completely cut from a different cloth in the West and do not appreciate our secular enlightenment values, right? This is sort of the clash of culture, clash of civilizations theory. I hope I'm not misrepresenting Hutchinson. I haven't read his book. I've only read about it. So, but I think that this is part of it. And what he's doing is saying, you like all of that is barely slant rhyme with the true history here. So he wants to do a corrective case. I thought that it was very interesting to read this, especially, you know, we are no longer in Afghanistan. It's the longest, well, I think the longest military engagement in US history. The sun has set on some of the foreign policy postures that provoked the occasion for this book. But we're still asking these questions in new and different ways because we still have fundamental questions about the nature of our political system, its ideological antecedents, and what they mean for us today, and also our relationship to nature as people who live in the wake of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment. What does this all mean? It seems like there is a crisis, a pervasive crisis of meaning and context in our culture. And so I think even if we have somewhat stepped beyond the window of history in which Gillespie wrote this book, he has much to tell us today.
I think I would concur with that. And it does bring to mind, I've talked to some people who have told me, like, yeah, I was talking to like my Muslim coworker, and there was just this like points about which they can't really understand. Now that I think about it, I'm like, yeah, like I think there's something to his argument that if we understand the history of European thinking in this way, like it actually does open up your ability to think about that specific, like that particular other, not that they're necessarily another, but like that's how people talk about it.
I think that's true. Whether or not Gillespie has a good read on Islamic intellectual history is something we will turn to at the end of the book and not something he addresses in these chapters.
Right. It's such an afterthought that the value in like 90% of the book, he doesn't really touch on that, and I think it works.
Regardless.
Yeah.
Maybe even in spite of. Okay, so let's talk about. I want to talk about some of the framing devices he uses to set up how he's going to do this investigation. And the main one, the one that there are two that I think are hugely important that he seems to be borrowing from Leo Strauss. Strauss is, I think, not the first person to formulate these antinomies or dichotomies, whatever we want to call them. But it's the difference between the ancients and the moderns, and reason and revelation. So we have, depending on who you are, inherited this idea that the modern thinkers who come out of the Scottish Enlightenment or whatever, are categorically different than the ancients. And that difference actually hinges on how they interpret the question of reason versus revelation. If you are in Christendom, if you're in Europe, you're in Christendom, basically. Reason versus revelation is a very live question because you are existing in a world of the book, the world of the Bible, where revealed truths by God are at least are actual. They're on the table for things that are capital T true and what those mean. But both reason and revelation pose different problems for each other because they're questions about the degree to which the world can be ascertained or understood by man. And so immediately there's a question is what is the status of God epistemologically, perhaps even like ontologically, phenomenologically? In other words, like, what does God know? How powerful is he? Questions of theodicy, right? Is he omnipotent? Is he omniscient? Is he all-loving? Things like that. And that's sort of the ontic question there too. And then sort of what is the world's relationship to this God? And how do we understand this world? Right. So all these things are bound up in each other and revolve around this distinction between reason and revelation and how we can set them up. And there are various Christian responses to that. The medieval world, as Gillespie paints it here, finds itself in a very interesting situation where there are two competing schools of thought in Christendom. And one is the scholastic band of thought, which, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but is really anchored around Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, I would say so within scholasticism, if you want to say that's a school, there are like sub schools. There are still some hardcore Augustinians in this period who, and Augustine represents something we'll get into later, which is like he sort of contains the seeds in many ways of nominalism and occasionalism in various ways, which are going to be two major themes that come up around this idea of God. There's also going to be like a huge variety of difference between Aquinas and other Aristotelians. There is a school, there's Averroism, which are people who kind of follow the Muslim Aristotelian Ibn Rushd or Averroes. And at points where he disagrees with Aquinas on some fundamental stuff, Aquinas, while making use of him, was also pretty critical of positions that he took. So I would say there's like a lot of difference even within just the, like the peripatetics of Christianity between themselves. And one thing that I've wondered, because Aquinas was obviously popular in his day, but I think that our image of Aquinas as being the doctrine of the church might be somewhat of a modern thing in that I feel like Aquinas represented a point which the Catholics could turn back to when they faced a lot of things in the 19th, 20th century in terms of like the world is changing and the power of the church is dissolving, modern science exists. So I'm not saying that Aquinas wasn't pretty dominant in his day and like, but I think that our image of him as sort of like the doctor to which all others kind of bow is, I'm just
Maybe a little
curious as to,
retconned. Yeah, maybe
yeah,
a little
that's what
retconned.
I'm thinking is it might be a little retcon, but there's a strain that's very Aquinas, and there's Gregory the Great who is also among them, and sorry, not Gregory the Great, someone else. Gregory the Great was a
So,
pope. But
yeah, so let
anyways,
me.
yeah, there's a I just I'm pointing there's a pretty rich body of thought with a lot of difference going on. But a lot of it at this point is very Aristotelian in one way or another, and that is kind of eventually the way of thinking about science and about theology that has come to dominate, especially in the fusion that Thomas Aquinas does.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm glad you dropped in the Aristotle thing. That's really important here. So we're going to sort of flatten this tradition because we don't have time to do apologetics for or deep genealogy of scholasticism. And Gillespie does a good job of explaining sort of the minimum program, if you will, of scholasticism. And part of it's a debt to Aristotle or Aristotelian thinkers and what is called realism at this time. And realism is the idea that there are true transcendental universals and that the world is a divinely imbued realization of that rational structure of the world. And there are a ton of different implications that fall out of that. One of them is that the reason of the mind can abstractly understand greater rhythms or patterns or the truth of the world at the abstract level, right? So, not even necessarily with empirical investigation. There are just things that are true and can be derived from reason as such. And that a well-ordered ethical life can be lived by reason, perhaps reason alone, but that doesn't mean that you have necessarily experienced the grace of God, which is sort of like the add-on to living the true Christian life. That's a part of this. And then the other thing is that I think is really, really important, especially because we're about to talk about nominalism, which you brought up, which is the other competing school, is the idea that all change is degeneration. And I really want to just say a little bit more about that and how they came to that conclusion. Now, I'm not going to walk through all the books that argue there. What I am going to try to do is give sort of a brief, like, step-by-step thing of how you would come to believe that, because I think that is one of the things that feels most different from how people view the world today. How do you get from this realist position to this idea that change over time is necessarily degeneration? And it's because of this sense that things are rightly ordered. And if through human fallibility and entropy, you change that order, you are corrupting what is the original truth of the case. You can see this play out in different fields of political thought, especially what will become to be called conservatism, and things like that. But you could also see how this creates a very rigid world that perhaps has not just hierarchies, because nominalism does as well, but it gives a lot of carte blanche to authority in a different way. And then there are huge questions about human freedom, its status, its nature, its consequences that come out of that perspective. And that is what nominalism inaugurated, Gillespie argues, by Occam of Occam's razor's fame. And its claims about God. Because an addendum to the scholastic claim is that God is rule bound, right? So God can't make a pizza
Maybe
so hot. Maybe is maybe rule bound,
we
perhaps
have to
rule
be
bound.
careful.
Yeah, we want to be careful, but
It's
is
a
light
point
up.
of deep and very precise contention among many people about what that exactly means, I guess.
Yeah, right. So we'll at least say that there's a debate about rule boundedness and that the
Or
nominalists are
God.
going to reject that frame entirely. And that's the break, right? So the scholastics are being like, can God make a pizza so hot that God himself can't eat it? You know, like stuff like that. You know, I'm being a little facetious here, but that's sort of the spirit of it. And then the nominalists are just like, I don't care about that at all. God is radically contingent and omnipotent and can do whatever God wants. And there are no universals, there are just particulars, which opens up incredible heterogeneity in addition to a heightened appreciation for human agency, perhaps.
Yeah, I think too, Just to provide a little clarification, since we've gotten into these concepts now, for anyone who still might not fully grasp it, like as we said, if you're like some kind of Aristotelian realist, you'll, for at least people in the Middle Ages, had kind of an inherited list of what's a universal that came out of Aristotle and then the writings of Porphyry and Boethius, who
And
had kind
Euclid.
of, yeah, they had kind of like this list of like, you know, things that are, they were dealing with categories which you might be familiar with today, which are species, genera, and things of that nature. And like, so the question is like, when I talk about something like a human being, which is a rational animal, so like animal, under animal, you have human being as like a subcategory or whatever. So like when you have this tree of being, of categories, of species and genera, are those real, like in the world real somehow? Are they real? Or are they real, but like they're not corporeal? So like they're real, but like in a non-physical realm somewhere. Like, is there just an ideal of them? Or are they not real in any either sense, and they're just something that exists in my mind alone? These questions were posited by Porphyry in a logic text that was one of the primary, like, first logic texts you would study in the Middle Ages. He asked these questions about them and says, "We're not going to get into that because you're too much of a neophyte, but I just thought you should know that people debate this stuff." And it proved to be extremely provocative to like every Middle Ages person after who read this and was like, "I would like to know." People answer these questions in different ways, and it's been a live debate since the, you know, the ancients. Like there have been, I would not want anyone to think that there were only realists until like Occam came along, because that's
No,
not true.
we could even make a distinction between somebody who has a Heraclitan perspective, and he's somebody that'll come back when we talk about Petrarch, who thinks that
Yeah.
all things are change and dynamism, and so can't be generalized in a certain sense or universalized. And then Aristotle's own incredibly teased out metaphysical architecture for the world, right? He was trying to do whole philosophy, right? Like he was doing the physics, the metaphysics, the logic. The politics, so he it was this whole encompassing system. And that's a live debate in Athens, right? So this is, and then again, we'll talk about the Stoics again when we get to Petrarch. This was something that the Romans encountered in their own way. And you can see that in the work of Seneca and things like that, or Cicero, the or Epicurus. There's a big divide, I think, in the Stoics between what might be a more pragmatic, quote unquote, lowercase p, stoicism that's about sort of living an honorable, dignified life, and then a more cosmic approach to it that has these larger metaphysical qu claims about the nature of the universe and the world and why stoicism is sort of the capital N natural path that falls out of that.
And on the other hand, when we say nominalism, it comes from nominal, like meaning name, and it's essentially advocating the position that when I designate a universal, that is merely a thought. Like it is a generalization made in thought and exists in thought alone. It is nothing but the name, I guess, is kind of the meaning of nominal there. And there are levels to nominalism as well. Like there are levels to realism. You can be an extreme nominalist and say literally, like these things are not real in any possible sense. They're delusions, even you could say. And they're.
Well, this is hotly debated even within. And one of the things that Gillespie does well is highlighting the way in which the thinkers that we encounter in this themselves have great ambivalence about trying to sort out these differences, right? Petrarch is a sort of a great example, as he's trying to figure out this middle path, perhaps between a scholastic position and a nominalist position. And that's all to say that even if these politically, and in some cases they did with the dawn of the Franciscan friars, who were hard nominalists and really advocated for a mystical experience of God, that the other thing that nominalism does is it really elevates revelation. over reason. And in that case, almost like this mystical personal relationship with God. And this is a threat, of course, to sort of the bureaucracy of the church, which is really like we're trying to get about the business of just living on this earth in some sort of godly way and also governing this political, philosophical fief that we have, this dominion. And you're in the way of trying to do that because we can't even make like basic generalizations about what the hell we're supposed to be doing with these lives. And I just want to add this little part. This is something that Augustine himself debates within the City of God and the two cities, the one heavenly, the one earthly, right? So this is, all this stuff is live debates. We've been fighting about it the whole way. And if you're like, how the hell could this even apply to my life? If you are the type of person that believes that history is progressive, meaning or can be progressive, that it has this, moving forward aspect in human life, well, then you can't be a postmodernist who also believes that there is a radical subjectivity and all of these things are just sort of narratives or competing narratives that we live with. And I think that would today be one of the closest approximations we get to a scholastic versus nominalist approach to thinking about the world.
I
So
think that's good.
okay, I want to talk about the nominalism a little bit more, right? Because I think that the sub rosa argument that Gillespie is happening here is that the modern project, he says at the top, is a product of this debate, but really it is about the problems that nominalism creates and the opportunities that it creates for new modes of thinking against the scholastic grain. Whether he's 100% right on that, I can't really say, but we're just going to try to represent his argument in a faithful way here for you to do your own thinking. By the way, you can read the book. You should re It's really well written. It's like remarkably clear. It's one of the more clear philosophical historiographies I've ever read, to be honest. Remarkably jargon free. Okay. So if you're a nominalist and you have this commitment to the radical contingency of God and the absence of universals, you also have this idea that no knowledge can be grasped prior to investigation. You have to sort of take each thing almost ad hoc, doing a little bit of violence to this here, but I'm just trying to sort of summarize this. And that means that there are no like primary causes. There's no telos, really. If there is, it's highly idiosyncratic for each person. The good life or the Christian engagement with God is on a case-by-case basis. Those of you who are Protestants are probably hearing a chiming in the back of your head if you're familiar with Luther or something like that. And don't worry, he comes out of this too. So I wrote down as one of my notes for this, no causes, no masters. That's sort of what's going on here, right? Because then you can't really have somebody tell you, well, this is what a or the relationship with God looks like. That's something that you're engaging with on your own. By faith alone, you could achieve salvation. That's something that the Reformation style Protestants are going to get to in the early modern period in European history, especially in Germany, the Netherlands, and England. Now, there is what is called the facientibus principle, and that's from the Latin phrase facientibus, quod in se est Deus non denegat gratiam. If you do what is in you, God will not deny grace. So here's how I've teased that out syllogistically. If God is radically free, and man is made in God's image, then man is also free. This is a highly radical proposition to make at this time, I think. John, what do you think?
That's an interesting something to pull out of that.
I was also listening to lectures on early English history, so I was doing a lot of deep diving in early Protestant theology.
I'll give my like gestalt on all of this as well, and maybe we'll come to like back to this as the point of meeting. One thing that was really interesting for me was the debates that were occasioned by like a strong nominalist position becoming like dominant in Europe, which is what happens. Like, just to be clear, Occam in his lifetime gains followers, but shortly after his lifetime, as Gillespie puts it, it's pretty hard not to find nominalism kind of reigning in every university. And even the major defenders of Aquinas are doing so, casting him in a pseudo-nominalist kind of way. So it's just become like the air in which you breathe, at least in this narrative, which I believe him about that. But I haven't looked into it. So he paints the world. The world that you got from Aristotle, as Emmett said, was extremely rule-bounded. Now, that might be a highly complex and open. You're not necess It's not vulgar. Like, although there are rules and there is causation, and that's kind of the primary thing that Aristotle is protecting for a lot of people, is the reality of secondary causation, where you can look at a thing, study it, and know it by its act in the world. And how else
You can
would you
see
know
its true nature, right? With like what it's
exactly?
destined to be. He uses the example of a tree in the physics, where it's like the telos of the seed is to become a tree. That doesn't mean all seeds become trees, but it means that is its natural great end. That is its purpose in the world.
And if you're an Aristotelian, this is the possibility of knowledge, is that like,
Yes.
so the fact that you have these existence, at least in some sense, when you talk about a universal, you're talking about a thing and you're not talking about a thought. And you're able to look and through investigation, understand the acts of things in which they reveal themselves. However, we won't get too into it. Never mind. But
I
it's really
was like,
difficult
careful, dude. Careful,
when
dude. We
you're talking
can't.
about Aristotle. It's difficult not to like keep digging a little further and
And
being
to
like,
like spurge out. You can
no,
see how this became like scholasticism that comes out of this becomes like incredibly internecine in some of its own debates.
I remember. But nonetheless, so you have things, they have acts, and when you look at them, you're like, these things are causing things in the world because there is a sort of deterministic relationship between all of this. And if you're a medieval thinker, it all starts from the heavenly bodies moving around, causing effects down here, and so on. And you live in a world where things cause things, and you can kind of like observe and understand that. And because of that, and because of the actual relationship of universals, which are part of your logical predications of things, exist in reality, and that reason has some existence in the structure of the universe, that means that you can know things, and like your knowledge of them is real and like absolute in some sense. You may be confused about something, but the possibility of that knowledge can really exist because everything is structured in a way that's amenable to reason. Now, that is, to my knowledge, first attacked in the Islamic world when this debate was happening a little earlier. And the primary like reason that there arose a position, like an anti-Aristotelian position, was that, as Emmett said, it felt as though the Aristotelians were saying, were in some way attempting to say that God was not completely free and completely omnipotent, and that there were certain things that God couldn't do. Now, pretty much 90, 99% of these theologians would agree that God can do anything except what's inconceivable. So, like, something logically inconsistent, they would also say, well, God, it's just not conceivable, so we're not even going to talk about it. But like these things of like, what is God's position in this world of like secondary causation? Like, does God need to intervene at the edge of it and the effects ripple out? Like, to the mainstream orthodox of Muslim theology, the answer is that's absurd. Like, the reason for that, and one thing, the reason that there are different responses, I think, in the Islamic and Christian worlds seems to be to the nature of the divine revelation. Yeah. Or for Christians, the Bible always kind of had lurking beneath the surface a sort of historicity, if you will. Like,
it's, and it was read as such, even up to Abraham Lincoln's day. People read the Bible as history.
Exactly. And there's, you know, that these books were composed at different times. You knew that there were a lot of them and that some of them were chosen and others were not. And there were apocryphal books. There is a sort of like, there's a lot of things coming together to put together the Bible. And exactly how are you going to read it? Like, what is it to you? Is it divinely inspired truth, or is it something in between that and historical document? You know, like, there are a lot
is
of
is it literal or not? Is becomes like
exactly.
A huge debate. Yeah,
there are a lot of possibilities when looking at the Bible for how you're going to understand it and what it means for like how you're going to see the world as revelation. Whereas in Islam, it's really, there's no debate. The Quran existed eternally. And it was sent down to Muhammad at this time, and it has been preserved since then. Like, when you're reading it, you're reading the literal word of God. And
yeah, that's baked into the cake in Islam in a way that it isn't. I should also say that even though Christ is a quoted prophet in the Quran very frequently, as I understand it, the problem of Christ is not front and center, obviously, in the way that it is in Christianity. But I also mean the idea of the Paschal Trinity is also not something that needs to be brokered. And the Paschal Trinity is a really, really difficult mystery to resolve. And just to put it this way, like in the Hebrew Bible, there is radical separation between God and man. This is a great theme of books like Job or whatever, God's engagement with Abraham and stuff like that. But Christ, as both God and man, represents this interpenetration between divine intervention and ontological status with human subjectivity. And that is why things like when he says, you know, the law says, you know, thou shalt not murder, but I say that even you who dreams of murder are a murderer in your own heart, right? You get this added element of not just the bare law, but this addition of the spirit of the law that is very concerned with your internal condition. So that is something that is patterning the Christian response to this differently than the Islamic response, I would say, as well.
Yeah, and sorry, I'm trying to collect my thought on that. I think that there are a lot of problems that Gillespie says people faced when they entered an alchemist universe that seemed like everything is contingent. There are no certainties. And the alchemists were taking lines very similar to what people like Al-Ghazali took, which is that God does not have to do anything. God could punish the virtuous and reward the sinners. That's possible for God. Whereas there were positions before that which seemed to say that that would be like inconceivable, like that just couldn't happen. And there were positions similar to that in Islam, which became marginal and eventually died out because this kind of, they call it occasionalism, reigned. And the Islamic formulation is extremely like radical in that.
Dude, it's wild. Islamic occasionalism is intense.
There is no secondary causation. There is only primary causation, i.e. God creating the world in every instant over and over again, all by pure divine will and action alone. And what you see as causation, and this is the origin of Hume's argument of the billiard balls, is actually just concurrence. But you can't actually witness causation empirically. It's not demonstrable. So all you're seeing is things concurring with one another. And the fact that there is regularity is like divine mercy, essentially, for you, that you can operate in this world. But but it's not something that in any way limits God, because that's just not, it couldn't be possible. Now that for Christians, at least as Gillespie paints it, seems to provoke a giant crisis in terms of like, what world am I living in? It seems dark, chaotic, and like impossible to
And
know.
it's a crisis of political authority. That's really important here too, right? Because if these causes can be known or whatever, they can be known by somebody, and dogma is created about that, about the nature of the world. And this is a time when only the priests are reading the Bible and things like this. This is what's so important about the idea of the German and English translations of the Bible into common tongue and stuff like that, right? So it creates a sort of, not a sort of, an actual body of theological thought that has real world implications for the administration of the church. And to deny those antecedents is to directly threaten the legitimacy of all of that architecture. And I think that is why it is a huge crisis in Christianity.
And what's fascinating to me is it didn't seem to provoke anything at all like this in Islam. Like, there was no crisis of political authority. There was no crisis about the world. So I was pondering this while reading this book a lot, because, and one of the things is I was like, it's perhaps the status of Revelation provides a lot more certainty to people who didn't really start out with an Aristotelian sense of the world and didn't kind of need it. And I think that it might be hard to understand if you're not a Muslim. I am, so that's how I can kind of talk about this, like from the inside a little bit. But
Yeah, and I'm Christian, so I'm sort of locked in this box forever, I guess.
it's just interesting, because there's, you see people saying like, well, how can I, like, what, how should I live then, or whatever, like, what am I supposed to do? And I'm like, you just have so much direct guidance from God in the Quran about these things that it's difficult. Like, it would feel inappropriate to like second guess that, I guess. It's just sort of unthinkable to me to read the Quran and be like, well, because of the philosophical position that God can do whatever he wants, how am I then to trust this? Like, you wouldn't say that. That would just be kind of absurd. And there is a lot of, you know, so you're living in a world without Aristotelian causality, but you also have like, you know,
There's
the
greater
idea.
surety in the fact of revelation itself, right?
Yeah,
That's what
and
it
you have,
sounds
well,
like.
the content of Revelation too, I think, gives you assurances that you just simply, in my phenomenological experience, really obviate the need for philosophical consolation on these matters. And I think that I'm curious if that's really a major difference between the two traditions. Like, there's a report of the prophet saying, I just thought of it when I was thinking about this, but he says, I heard the messenger of Allah saying, when Allah created the creatures, he wrote in the book, which is with him over his throne, my mercy has prevailed over my wrath. And there are kind of things like this all over the place where you're assured that the divine mercy predominates over all the other attributes, but you're not assured of exactly what that means or how it means, and God can do whatever he wants. So it's not really like, philosophically, you have this focus on omnipotence in order to protect proper understanding, but you also have all of these other things that balance it out and give you sort of a sense of comfort. It's one of the major aspects of the religion, is the phenomenological experience of walking with both hope and fear at all times. Like,
Yeah.
you're afraid of what you could do and what could happen to you, but you're also hopeful for a mercy that you could never possibly understand, because it constantly outstrips anything you could ever imagine, because it's divine. So I think that that is not for nothing, and it probably explains a lot of the ways in which philosophy could take this position. Those, some people say Occam was probably just familiar with these arguments from the Muslim world. I haven't looked into that, but nonetheless, pretty much the same position on the radical omnipotence of God and the radical contingency of everything else, without like civilizationally destabilizing effects, or like what came out of them and all this stuff. And I think that's it's an interesting background because these two conversations kind of went on in parallel and went in radically different directions. So,
No, I think that's true. I should also say that the Orthodox Church has its own, or Orthodox churches, I guess, has its own responses to these, and it's very steeped in the perpetuation of tradition and revelation through mystical experience, and that becoming embedded in tradition that resolves a lot of these. It becomes, they see it as the Catholics and the Protestants have made a false distinction between, faith and works. And so that's like a whole other thing of this. And so, yeah. Okay. So let's
They're
move out of
really like
here.
the forgotten church of the church.
Yeah, like, they were doing it originally, I guess. So it's kind of weird that they've been so forgotten. But okay. So here's what nominalism, to bring it back to this, right? One of the, and to tie it to some of what John just said about Islam, if you're listening carefully, you realize that if there is this nominalist world and God is acting in it, then suddenly what you're watching is not the disclosure of the nature of the world and its static transcendental universals, but a world that is becoming as a manifestation of God's will. And Gillespie argues that this is the ontological foundation for the self-consciousness of modernity, that becoming becomes more important than causes or anything like that. And if you want to know what that might mean, his discussion of Francis Bacon as somebody who's responding to this as well, the father of science as we've inherited it, is really helpful, where he's like, well, I don't think I can know what these things are in and of themselves, but I can see what they do and report faithfully on that. And then there's something that comes out of that also, and it's that change is not degeneration. It is merely a manifestation of God's will. And so there's this radical democratic aspect to what Bacon is doing as well, because it's not necessarily about the capital B best life, but rather this accumulation of human endeavor that provides greater insight into how we witness this manifestation on a day-to-day basis. And that is the seedbed for the idea of scientific progress at all.
And it's kind of on its surface, feels like he's still doing Aristotle, but he's doing it in a subtly different way. Like, because, like we said, for Aristotle, observing becoming, in the sense that you're observing the act of a thing, is how you understand things. But for Bacon, you now lack act, like, you're not positing an eternal understanding of like a telos of a thing. You're just recording enough, and like,
Phenomena.
you're empirically understanding phenomena till you can generalize essentially about it. And those are two different things in kind of a fundamental way.
Yeah, and that's sort of the groundwork of the scientific method, right? Is that, you're watching concurrence and you're trying to figure out what might be the general pattern that you could most, with the greatest apodictic certainty, to borrow from Kant, report to others and make a strong claim on. And that's what's happening in the scientific method. We're skipping over some of the Hobbes and stuff like that. That's all important, but there is going to be chapters on Hobbes later on in this book, and we're going to dig into all that later. By the way, just so you guys know, we are actually, John and I talked, we're going to read through some Bacon and after this book. And we're going to really get into the groundwork of the dawn of science and its major change in the West. Obviously, he's not the only one that does that. There's Newton or whatever. But Bacon is greatly neglected despite his immense influence. So we're going to talk about some of that too. So we're not going to get too into the nitty-gritty here because we already gave you guys a heavy dose of scholasticism and nominalism in both Europe and the Islamic world. What we are going to do is pivot to some of the claims that Gillespie wants to make about this. So I talked about the postmodern modernist distinction that was going on as sort of this simile for this debate that we live with today. And I want to say that Gillespie is going to point out that there are two major elements of the modern project that fall out of guys like Bacon and Newton and stuff like that. And it the two goals of modernity are to master and possess nature, which is a departure from the ancient perspective, which was really about girding yourself against nature, right? And sort of the perpetuation of the historical cycle from like rise to the golden period and then decline into chaos and then rebirth out of that and the great flood myths. If anybody wants a
Of
very,
the garden,
yeah, if
it's
anybody
like
wants a very difficult but shockingly important book to read about this, it would be Vico Giambattista's or Giambattista Vico's The New Science.
I think he's going to come up in a later chapter of
I
this.
would not be surprised if he does. So we'll have
Yeah.
occasion. That's a book I've read twice and I still very much don't get it. But anyway, the two goals of modernity, master and possess a possessor of nature and to enable human freedom. And that's the project we live with today, right? That is what we are debating. What are the merits of that? What are the trade-offs of that? Is it true that that's what we're doing? Can it even be done? How are we to reckon human freedom? And you can see how that is not a successful overcoming of the deadlock or debate between scholasticism and nominalism, but this almost, if we want to be mildly Hegelian, like attempt at a synthesis between these two positions to figure out what it is we're supposed to be doing anyway.
Right. Like one of the things that he kind of gets two strains, which we won't go too into it, but it's important to at least mention that there's Descartes who kind of posits that man is outside of nature, like ontologically, and thus, like man is free. Like man is not bounded by the rules which we are sort of the determinism that seems to exist within things. Man is not subject to that for Descartes. However, for Hobbes, man is radically a part of nature, and thus the question of human freedom seems closed. Like there's not any.
No,
You're
yeah,
just
he's
doing
very
what you're
clear about
doing.
that.
So there, it's for the project of human freedom to have this at its heart is something that has not gotten resolved and continues to be real even today, and it has existed since the opening of this. Of the beginning of these ideas.
Which should if you're American, make you realize how bananas it is that the Constitutional Convention and mostly Thomas Jefferson was like, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Like, that is such a wild take to come to, sort of at the crest of this moment. I want to read this actual entire paragraph. We're going to move on to Petrarch and sort of the creation of the modern interior life that is interesting and will be featured in greater depth in our next episode on this. But this is on sort of the crisis that modernity brings, the ontic turn, right, that we were talking about, watching all of this becoming, right? That's sort of what he's talking about. That's what Gillespie's talking about. And he does this brief little paragraph on Plato's Parmenides that I just think is like so perfect. First of all, as an explication of what's at stake in that dialogue, but also how it helps us understand why modernity has always believed itself to be unique and uniquely in crisis. Just think back to almost any time in history since the modern era, and there's always some crisis going on, either intellectually or in the world or both, right? Okay. At the end of modernity, we are thus left to confront the question whether there is any solution to this problem within the ontological horizon that modernity opens up, and thus whether modernity, even in its most secular form, can escape from the metaphysical theological problem with which it began. In his Parmenides, Plato explores the primordial question of the one and the many. This question is primordial because it cannot be answered, and it cannot be answered because it is itself the presupposition of all thinking, and therefore of all questioning and answering. We cannot think about things without making those things as both being both one and many. There are different explanations for this dilemma, some rooted in the contradictory nature of existence and others, and the inadequacy of language to grasp being, but we need not go into those matters here. It is sufficient for our purposes to recognize that there is no unequivocal answer to this question. As a result, there can be no final theoretical vision of the whole that can serve as the absolute, fundamental, unshakable truth. Neither a Parmenidean dwelling on the one nor a radical individualism or nominalism can dissolve this contradiction, nor can it be eliminated by means of a linguistic turn that imagines everything to be the play of mere words or signs, a language game or games that create the world anew every time we speak. This question thus underlies and shapes all philosophizing. Plato's Parmenides argues that the attempt to explain the world either through the one without reference to the many or through the many without reference to the one is doomed to failure. Nominalism rejects realism because it goes too far in the direction of the one, positing an identity between God and his creation. Nominalism, by contrast, draws a sharp distinction between the two, and as a result, puts great emphasis on manyness and particularity. So I read that paragraph, and I was like, if I ever write something that lucid about Plato and fundamental philosophical questions, all have been a success. But this is what's at stake here, and I want to dwell on this a little bit, right? Because we have questions of democracy, which has epistemic ideas about reason's availability to everyday people and how that works. That doesn't mean every nominalist is a Democrat, far from it, but we can see how that creates new horizons from which to view the human experience and to resurrect what was the bete noir of all political philosophy up until the modern era, which was the idea of democracy itself. And we can also see different ideas about expertise and what can be known and who knows it and what kind of power that confers. We see all of these problems tied up in these distinctions. And there's going to be a surprising response to this from Petrarch, who, if any of you studied literature, you might remember from those days, the idea of the Petrarchan sonnet. I know I wrote terrible versions of those. English is not well suited to it, sadly. And nor is my English, it turns out. It's even worse fitted to that schema. Better to stick with the Shakespeare and fail at that instead. However, Petrarch had a, he was sort of this international courtesan who talked with all sorts of religious figures and political figures, friend to all, ally to none, basically. Because Petrarch had some ideas about what the individual engagement with these problems was going to be. And it is a surprising turn away from public life itself and into interior life. John, I'll let you get a word in edgewise here.
Yeah, it's for someone a little familiar with like Roman literature, you can see how it's on a classical model in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. We talked about it in our other series when we talked about Virgil, but like yes. Virgil and Horace and a lot of these writers during the reign of Augustus have this idea of like political life might have some meaning, but it also sucks. And I would like to get away to the country where I can just tend to some animals and write and think and like do my little literary thing. And that is the mode in which Petrarch chooses to live to a fault, is kind of the rejection of any political or public life, even though it's offered to him a lot, seemingly, especially the more famous he gets. He kind of becomes in his own way, like his day's version of a Horace, mm-hmm. where he's a writer, but also a very famous public figure in the sense that people know about him, but he kind of doesn't really want to be. And I think he is extremely relatable in the sense that when you have read a lot of like metaphysical thinking in the Aristotelian vein or otherwise, you can kind of get to a point where you feel sick and you're like, I just want to know how to live and I don't care anymore about
Yeah.
this. And I
Yeah,
think
yeah.
that Petrarch kind of reserved, he's like, I just want to know how to live, and like questions of like that sort are what dominate for him. And a big one is like, how can I live virtuously and restrain my passions so that my And reason for him is kind of like the operative way of like living rightly and like living virtuously rather than being so much about knowledge. It's more of about like reason as a faculty that enables you to act a certain way and to not give in to like lower desires. And for him, it's kind of the main concern is how do I do that? And he turns, or for at least the first half of his work, largely to classical authors who Gillespie calls moralists, and he includes among them Horace and Livy. And, it's for anyone who hasn't read Livy, I'm not going to say that you should, but like I would do it, and I have done it. And I think it's, you're just like, you read it and you like get what he's talking about. And there's,
Same with Plutarch, by the way.
Plutarch as well. And there's, this is something that has existed for a long time. Like, and I'm saying like people reading Livy, like there's a Tennyson poem set about events that happened in the first the early Rome portions of Livy, where someone needs to hold the bridge against the enemy to buy time for the Romans to do something. And so this guy's like, I'll do it, And then Tennyson writes this nice little poem about it. And, it represents for the British, like what an ideal British officer would be like. But many people are reading this and it's a wellspring of like virtus, as in like manly action and like what it means to be a man and how to be. And I think that for Livy, when he opens the annals of history, he's sitting down to tell you exactly who were the exemplars of that kind of action, in the hope that that kind of man can continue to exist. And so there are many, many stirring passages of that nature kind of throughout Livy. And it's really easy to see how if you were someone feeling lost and like there wasn't really a guide for how a human being should be anymore, which it seems like that is kind of becoming the case in Petrarch's time, you would, if you found this stuff, you would feel kind of inspired, like, oh, like I kind of get it now. Like maybe this is the guide that I was looking for. So it's a big thing for Petrarch, but the other big thing for Petrarch is Saint Augustine, who kind of mediates the classicism in a way by bringing in a focus on your nature as someone who has fallen and like failed to be good, and your struggle against that. And Gillespie points out that for Saint Augustine, this is about sin and redemption and the grace of God. But it seems like in the case of Petrarch, it's far more about virtue, which has less of a focus on grace and more of a focus on like, have I lived virtuously or not? And like, attempting to overcome your failures. So it's an interesting mediation between like a classical kind of idea and a more Christian idea. Because for Augustine, there's definitely like, you're not getting anywhere like without the grace of God. Like you are a failure. You are a failure without that. Like that is the only salvation. Whereas for Petrarch, it's more ambiguous, and like not exactly clear how that operates, if at all. At least in Gillespie's reading of him, and that, he's not like a crypto pagan. I don't think that. And I don't, some people might argue that, but I don't think that's true. I think he is a
I think he's
Christian.
too sincere in his Christian commitment to
Yeah,
be a
no, he's
crypto
a
pagan.
genuine Christian, but I think he's trying to work out problems in a new world, and like he has different models. Like Livy, I don't think Augustine cared at all about Livy because Livy was arguing for the glory of the Republican past. And for any Christian author of that era, the Republican past was the dominance of paganism, and the Christian present was like what you should be thinking was cool in terms of Roman history, which occasioned Augustine's student Orosius to write seven books of history against the pagans, I think, which are all about how all these great Romans and Livy that you love actually sucked, and like things got better when Christianity was introduced.
Yeah, that's been, and then this gets recapitulated again, like, you know, if we want to do the rise and fall of the rise and decline of the Roman Empire, the Gibbons book, where he's just like, actually what sucked was Christianity, because it made them all weak little bitches and they lost their republican virtue, you know what I mean? So there's
But
that
for
going
the,
on too.
it's just probably good to know that for like the entire history of Christianity, there has been a noted sort of tension between a classical impulse and like, what does that mean for the Christian commitment? Because things classical are things pagan.
Yeah.
But people think that they're really cool and they love them. There's the famous letter, I think it was from the disciple of Bede who was in Charlemagne's court, but he says, you know, what does Ingeld have to do with Christ to the British people who are reading these Northern Germanic pagan like sagas to each other, like probably in monasteries, they're like reading the stuff and loving it. And he's like, what has Ingeld to do with Christ? And there's a really, really funny exposition on from another one of Charlemagne's like A team intellectuals, where he's going through what are like these classical mythological sort of stories that you see in art and stuff. And he's just like, you know, are these things Christian? Like, should a good Christian be concerned with them? And then he just like encyclopedically goes through them all. And someone points out, like, for somebody who thinks it's not good, he sure knows a lot about it. So I think that's maybe a good illustration of, like, since the early Middle Ages, people have been thinking about this. And what does it mean to, on one hand, have this body of like formative literature that you study and find moving in various ways that are also made by people who you think are benighted and like beyond
Right. And
somewhat.
We see this in Dante too, right? Like when he goes down to hell, I mean, first of all, Virgil is his guide. You know, he sees some of the famous philosophers and historians he loves. They're still in like not the worst part of hell, but they're still, it's, or they're in purgatory, so they'll never be in heaven. You know, there are different ways that this gets expressed and in the literature and the cultural expressions of this. How Petrarch resolves this is really to become the father of what we end up calling humanism. So his idea is the virtuous life is this retreat from the public world to basically hang out with all your smart friends because you're smarter and better people, which he believes, by the way. That's not me being like shitty to him. He was an elitist. Like that's part of what this project is. And like unabashedly, you know, and I think we should take him on the merits of that. Because that's an important thing to do. Like that's what he means. That's what he sees. And to also engage in a communion of friendship with the dead great authors. And he means friendship as friendship. It was very common to think, even in the Roman era, that you could closely, methodologically, repeatedly read the great authors of the past and cultivate a friendship with them, which I still think is both insane and beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, like I love it. I think like I have all these anxieties about like how do you really know? And then at the same time, I'm like, I don't care. That's awesome. You know? And I think this is where Gillespie's going. We'll see if this forecast is right as we sort of bring this episode to a close, is that this is going to be the groundwork for the Renaissance and what starts to happen in that early modern period that gives way to the modern world as we know it, especially in the 1600s, because there's a lot of time spent on Hobbes and then Descartes and stuff like that as we move through this book. But that's where this is going, is that this is going to create a very particular kind of social habitus, a certain kind of subjectivity, for to use an anachronistic term, a kind of gentlemanliness that makes socially and ideologically the Enlightenment project not just possible but desirable from those who have been awarded the leisure time and capacity to live this kind of life and produce great works. So if it feels like we went all over the place, don't worry. We're going to be touching on these themes over and over again as we go through. We hope for the people that like these reading series that you like it, but
You know, before we
give it a
close out
shot.
too, I learned one thing that I think illustrates something maybe important to know is when I was looking into some of the scholastic stuff, I came across the fact that if you wanted to study medieval philosophy, your choices were to go to a Catholic university where you would study Aquinas and some related people, or I don't know, like that's it. Like, until the 1970s, there were no critical editions of most medieval philosophers who were not paid attention to by like modern Catholics, just at all. Like, you studied the ancients or you studied modern philosophy. A lot of the thinkers who lay all the groundwork for the early chapters of this book were literally ignored by the academy until the 70s. When people started finally getting critical editions of Occam, of Duns Scotus, and realizing that they might have actually been saying something and weren't stupid, which to me is like so late and like fascinating to think that
Yeah,
that happened.
there's all sorts of stuff that happens like this. And I mean, this is, it is a shame that more direct study of these things has become so much less robust in the contemporary period. There's so much about the past that we don't haven't even begun to understand. So this is a step towards that direction because I think it helps us appreciate what is at stake when we're talking about things like the use of energy in human life and the political impacts of that, what it means to scale up a society where expertise is necessary, but has anti-democratic conclusions when it's institutionalized, and how we broker that, what the role of science is in human life, and whether or not even its progenitors were huge boosters of it without criticism. I think we find with Bacon, there was great anxiety also about what he was creating. And I think it's important to realize that what we experience as the fundamental debates about technology in human life are still debates about the nature of humanity and how we ought to live, and that we have not escaped many of the fundamental questions that so vexed our forebears. That's why we're doing this, so that we can get a better handle on our own context. Because I think without context, you are doomed to the propaganda of modernity. This is one of the main things I would say as a critique of it, is its commitment to its terminal uniqueness that I think inhibits us from understanding the world that we live in and that modernity has created. So,
It's like the famous quote of Cicero that's in the beginning of most like Latin textbooks or whatever is the people who refuse to understand history are doomed to forever remain children.
yes, yeah. I think that's the issue. So hopefully this is helpful. Hopefully you liked it. We're going to keep moving through this. We've got Bacon lined up. We also want to do some stuff on the Romantics. And I think we're also going to do some one-offs perhaps at some point. We know that Hume wrote a bunch of essays on the nature of technology, as did Carlyle, and they might be fun people to juxtapose every now and again. As always, you are welcome to comment on this. If you're in the Substack, by the way, I've been writing more over there, so subscribe to that. Leave comments with questions, et cetera, and we'll see what we can answer when we can answer it. Maybe at the end of this book, we'll do a general Q&A based on this series to see if we can't sort of address things that we wouldn't intuit on our own, but that have provoked you guys. And so that might be a difference in structure between the Machine in the Garden series and this one. So, at long last, we will see you next time. Thank you for being on this journey with us. John and I really enjoyed doing this. Remember, stay sharp, stay strong, stay radiant. See you next time.